Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. And of course, you've come to expect this now. There is no better way to begin The Attitude than with some edgy political verse. So hit it, Ken. Saner voices are urging him to concede, but he believes the courts will intercede. Three wise judges he appointed. In his dreams, he will be anointed with holy oils and judicial decree. And now, our first guest, Bob Hennelly. You can find him at Stuck Nation. He writes for InsiderNJ.com, Salon.com, The Chief Leader. We have now become, he's become one of the favorites on The Attitude. And I was talking to him and I saw a piece that he wrote. I have to tell you, I started pulling quotes out of your piece at InsiderNJ. It was entitled, "How Many People Will Perish in the Canyon of Our Growing Red-Blue Divide." And what you don't know is that on yesterday's show, Bob, I kind of said that. I kind of talked a little bit about that, not seeing your piece, but it was part of the conversation in our roundtable. Right. And then, of course, what lands on my computer, but your most recent piece at Insider NJ. And I do think we were separated at birth. So welcome back to the program. And let's talk about it. You use the lens of New Jersey, but that isn't really even necessary because what's happening in New Jersey is happening across the country because the divide isn't between red and blue states. It goes much deeper.
I think that in the elation that came with the immediate results at the top of the ballot, we became victim to the fact that even on a good day, America's corporate media can cover one story barely, right? You have two threads, that's just going to melt them down. And so they could do the jubilation story, but the fact that, and it's a tough task, we have an ongoing, unprecedented public health emergency that's playing out now, that's getting worse by the hour across the country in the form of the pandemic. And if you just scratch below the surface, you'll see that Donald Trump got several million more votes than he did in 2016. He cleaned the clock of Democrats up in your neck of the woods. Across the country, they lost House seats, not a lot, but people were predicting they were going to pick up seats. In New Jersey, we saw a situation where Donald Trump carried several counties and added to his vote totals in such suave places as Bergen County. And in New York State, Biden only carried 13 of 62 counties. And so the reality is that, and what's particularly of concern and potentially tragic, is that this campaign has been about the pandemic and the results are very divided. And so while Biden may have carried the day, when it comes to local situations, which is where the pandemic is being fought, won, lost, or draw, the Trump worldview is still very much in evidence. And we could potentially lose another couple of hundred thousands of people before Joe Biden raises his hand on the family Bible.
And even after he raises his hand, he can't order with a gun, "You must wear a mask." I mean, he's been talking the first words out of his mouth. I mean, he just announced on Monday morning, you know, the group of folks who will, in fact, be part of his pandemic COVID-19 team. That's the first thing he did. Right. So obviously, focus, focus, focus. And what does he say? He talked about until we have a vaccine. And we now know that there's one that may be showing up, but it won't be showing up until the spring. And we still don't even know some of the consequences of it. And it needs to be kept at sub-zero temperatures. And I mean, just the ability to even administer it is going to be an incredible challenge.
Right.
He talked about the fact that before we get the vaccine, the crude vaccine is the mask. But we know that the mask now is triggering politics in a way no other article of anything, clothing, whatever, has really sort of, it sends this incredible message. And that's why your story at Insider NJ is so important, is that as you sort of look into New Jersey, which overwhelmingly voted for Joe Biden, but then you look at community after community that didn't. And right. Even within those communities that didn't,
right.
There still are a significant number of folks that have embraced Donald Trump. And they will not wear a mask. They may not even believe in the pandemic, despite the fact that they're seeing numbers creeping up, and they may even be hearing ambulances. But for whatever reason, they have blinders on, or they don't want to embrace the bad news.
Right. I will tell you that I think I diagnosed this in a way that I don't think I've seen before, which is the reality that with the death of local news, something we've talked about, like the local newspapers, like imagine a 17-year-old version of myself, like half a century ago, would cover local municipal hearings with three other adults who had children who I was studying under, who were adults covering local meetings. This was their job. That architecture is gone. What's in its place? Well, social media, that is how we draw our situational awareness, driven to us by analytics based on confirmation bias. So,
and logarithms.
You can take an event, and this is where the herd mentality is what we're dealing with. You can take events unrelated to your personal experience in Portland, Oregon, which show looting on in New York City when that was happening and during that brief period of time. And that becomes your situational awareness. Now, there's a problem with that. And this goes to the FCC deregulating the news. It means that for the purpose of two things that are important to have a country, civil defense and public health, you don't have a common fact pattern. And that's the issue here. And everyone else is talking around it, but that's a thing that has to change, because as long as we don't have a common sense of a situational awareness, we're going to be at each other's throats.
Well, and so what you're going to imagine is Detroit, it's Minneapolis, it's Seattle. That's your version of a city, you know, because that's the only city, and you see it on cable news 24/7. And right. On Fox, even if it settles down, you'll still be seeing the old tape, you know, of 24/7. And you wrote something in your piece I just have to read to everyone, because we're sort of so elated, and there's no question we should be happy that at least the Trump in the White House era is over.
Right.
Not Trumpism,
right.
But Trump in the White House is over. And this is an unbelievable piece. You write, and it's a quote, "It's an epic underperformance." We're talking about how poorly Democrats did down ballot. And I want people to hear this paragraph because I want them to understand what this means. "It's an epic underperformance by Democrats. For all the money spent, Democrats aren't going to be able to draw a single new congressional district as a result of this election that they hadn't been able to draw before." That is an unbelievable statement, given the millions of people that showed up to vote, given the billions, let's be honest, I'm sure it's up to billions right now, that was spent on this election. So this is what he writes. So he tells this to The Hill, and then he continues. This is Michael Behm, a lobbyist. He says, "The Republicans have been able to protect every majority that they needed to draw congressional lines."
Right.
This is the most unbearable sort of statistic of that I have read. Not one new congressional district. And let me remind everyone who is losing districts and who is gaining districts. Texas, which we so hoped would flip, is going to be able to rewrite their districts, but they're gaining districts.
Right.
So not only are they going to see new emerging patterns, they're going to actually gain potential votes in the House of Representatives.
Right. And this migration pattern that has been happening for a while from the people, the concentration in the East to the West and the South, will no doubt pick up speed. And the other problem here is that the way this is being framed now is that this is the blame for this is being placed on the progressives. You probably heard that Joe Scarborough received wisdom that
yes,
their progressives were really lucky. They almost lost Biden the election. Well, the only place I saw a pulse raised, as Michael Moore's made this point, was in the communities of color that delivered. I've looked at the data. I mean, I go down into the county level because that's where America is stuck. America is stuck at the county level, and that's where the battle has to be joined. And what's more emergent is, for this public health question of the pandemic, we have to call these questions. One of the things that I'm stunned by is the level of illiteracy about the nature of this virus itself. And that's something that really needs to be looked at. I mean, I spend my days immersed in conversations with the people doing this work, the first responders, EMTs, firefighters, the chief. I just got off the phone. I spent the whole day talking with people where worker comp claims are being denied from people that have gone into the field, came down with COVID, survived, and now have either coronary, respiratory, or nervous system complications. Right. Now, nobody is talking about this. One third of the people who have a bout with this thing have lingering symptoms. It can be as subtle as Epstein-Barr and as dramatic as a heart condition you didn't have before. So that's what we're in the middle of right now. So the degree to which we can prevent that from stepping off, we'll be able to reduce the footprint of this tragedy in the future.
So I have to ask a question. We know that the most watched cable station in America is Fox, right? The most watched. If Donald Trump is gone, and Donald Trump has been pushing and insisting on COVID denial, he's been insisting on science denial, he's been insisting, and they have basically been his echo chamber. They have mirrored everything he's said and taken it to an extreme, okay? With him gone, are they going to continue to pursue COVID denial? Well, are they going to continue to pursue science denial? Are they going to wait for a vaccine that may not arrive? I mean, we may have it, but no one may be able to access it till the spring or the summer. And again, we know that this one has an efficacy supposedly of 90%, but you know what? It's still so soon. We don't know what the consequences are 1 month, 2 months, 3 months out, because they're still really in this process. And who gets the vaccine? I mean, let's be honest here. What are we going to, have a lottery to get the vaccine, so we can assure people that we're not looking at gender, we're not looking at wealth, we're not looking at geography, that whoever gets there first is going to get, like, it's kind of like when you're called up for the military service, you know, what's your number, you know? And I'm just kind of curious how Fox is going to behave, given the fact that this is about death, this is about long-term health complications, and this is about breaking your healthcare system.
So there's a lot there. And so there's at least three things that were raised here. One, I've been monitoring Fox, and I always do. And what we've seen is they started parting company with the president when they called Arizona, something they called it, you know, relatively early compared to MSNBC, NBC. And then also they actually did have the... did put on the screen President-elect Biden, which I'm sure many minds imploded. But there's something else out there called One America News. Have you had the pleasure of looking at that reactionary craziness? Mm-hmm. Let me tell you, you'd probably know the story of the dedicated Japanese soldier who I believe it's anecdotally was still believing there was a war many decades later on a remote island in the Pacific. Well, imagine that in today's age you're providing something for your delusion with a video feed to enable it, that there was a video feed into his cave telling him that indeed Emperor Hirohito was holding the orange sun intact. Well, that's kind of what One America News is. So you got to start watching that, because that's where Donald Trump will show up. That's what they've created, his little nest for him.
Okay, so who is behind One America News? Is it cable? Is it only internet?
It's cable. And it's got the same formula. Imagine Fox in the beginning. So that's the exile. That's the Alba for Mr. Trump. Now, on the question of the vaccine, there are questions about the fact... Look at the fact that we lacked the consensus for having vaccines for children for school when Donald Trump was still trying to mess up Barack Obama's reputation. This lack of national cohesion that set the stage for this moment, our national crisis, is a consequence of decades of erosion where we couldn't have this kind of scale of compliance when it came to things like polio. I mean, if you rolled out even now, like the polio vaccine, there would be multiple, and not to say, for instance, that that multinational corporations and pharmaceuticals aren't suspect, but I just don't think we have the faith in each other enough to administer widespread vaccine.
You know, there was a, I think I may have mentioned this before, but they were interviewing someone, I think it was in Nebraska or Oklahoma, who, where it was raging in his town and the COVID was spiking, and he refused to wear a mask. And she said, do you not see people getting sick? He goes, yeah, but you could get sick. He goes, yeah. And then he said, you could die. He said, and it will say on my tombstone, he refused to wear a mask. Well, this was how he processed. Now, I've said it before, and I will say it again. If it was just him that got sick, if it was just him that died, die. You know, I believe, I actually believe in not euthanasia necessarily, but I believe in death with dignity. You can make your decision about your end of life. The problem with his decision about sickness and end of life is that it impacts my life. It isn't just discreet to him. It is to his community. It's to his minister and his postman and his grocer. And that's where I am trying to figure out. We had a guy on the air yesterday who used a really powerful word. His name is Paul Peter Jessup. And we were talking about the 70 million plus that voted for Donald Trump, you know, the second highest number in U.S. history.
Right.
And he said, we have to use another word when we're talking about that 70 plus million. He said, the word is, how do we rehabilitate them?
Right.
What an interesting word to use. Because when you think of rehabilitation, it's like a criminal record. When you think about rehabilitation, it's a drug addict. But we have both a drug addict and a criminal record. I mean, let's be honest. These mass events, these super spreader events, really are criminal when you realize the consequences of what of they are to this, you know, potential for health complications as well as death. And yet, how do you rehabilitate 70 million when you have social media and now this other news service you just described?
Right. I would say that part of the issue here is that the concept of you might want to identify with the blue state consciousness, although, as we said, even within the blue states, there's division, so it's hard to mobilize with intent. But you have the notion behind a mask, a concept of collective action for the well-being of others, right?
Right, exactly.
And that has been shorthanded into socialism and then exaggerated into being a Stalinist plot. On the other side of this polarity, you have the red state consciousness, which is that the mask represents an imposition of a hidden agenda by the secret state on my personal liberties that diminish me. And any impingement on that is something that is just eroding a natural right. And they speak in those terms. And so this lack of cohesion has been around for a long time. And it's come at the same time as almost every institution that was kind of the glue of our culture has gone through its own profound changes. I mean, you could just, we've talked about this before, the Catholic Church, scouting, you name an institution, the financial, the banks, anything that has had in our past that was part of the foundations of the country has fallen into disrepute.
You wrote a piece, we were talking about Rudy Giuliani and how what yeah. he did with the, especially with the firefighters in New York. Yeah. But it just occurred to me that what was so interesting about the reaction to 9/11 was there was a huge collective reaction. I mean, there really wasn't, and there were a couple of people that were sort of, you know, 9/11 deniers, but for the most part, universal right. red state or blue state. And we were ready to do anything. And what did George Bush do? But in a way, he wasted this opportunity right. to do good, to do right, to do investment, to do things that we could have come together on. Instead, what did we do? We were told to shop. We were told to normalize the economy because he was more afraid of the market tanking and people not going to Target.
Well, and then also, right, and but then also not only that, but we then launched a never-ending war on terrorism, which proliferated terrorism at the same time, and then relied on a volunteer warrior class, which has been in the field now for a number of four decades. Right. And so that it's interesting you raise this because what was happening at the same time from the Vietnam War era was a very cynical decision that was made by Nixon to go with a volunteer army. Right. And so now if you look closely at this kind of militia culture, this law enforcement alienation culture, it's often composed of these permanent warriors who, because we've given up on the concept of civilian military that's informed by National Service, and Colonel Basevich, I don't know if you've had him on, but he's written brilliantly about that. He's
brilliant about this.
Right. And that was one big block. And it's funny because at the time when Nixon had the panel that came up with this idea of ending the, and this is like, you know, boiling us like a frog very slowly. We went from a military where you had to have some public support because you were reaching into people's lives and pulling them out of this civilian life and compelling them to be in the military. They came up with a very cynical idea that what they should do is just not bother you and make it being in the military just a lifestyle choice. And so that's another example of this splitting away where we could be at war and not feel any responsibility for it.
Well, and I feel like in a bizarre way, we're at war with COVID, and some people have this no sense of responsibility because, right. And that's, you know, I mean, it's artificial to them, the way the war in Afghanistan was artificial to them. They knew that some people were going, they knew that some, but they didn't quite comprehend it.
Well, that, right.
It didn't touch their lives.
Well, that's the atrophy of polity. That is the atrophy of agency. That's what happens when you're not called upon to sacrifice for generation after generation, and your life is a lazy Susan. You just suppose it just keeps working. So the little people that make it happen, well, that's nice for them, but it's not my problem.
Well, and let's look who's dying from COVID. Contracting COVID. Let's look at who the frontline workers are. Let's look who's at grocery stores. Let's look who's meatpacking. It's not the people that will ever serve in the military. That's for sure. I mean, it's interesting that it's a parallel track.
Right,
who is expendable in America? Actually, that's the title of your next piece. Who is expendable in America? Using the voluntary military, using the story of our response to COVID. And what is so frightening is that it's from the same communities. It's the same color. It's the same, you know, economic disparity. It's remarkable what we have done. Right. If you want to divide us, we have worked really hard at making sure the divisions are permanent.
Right, and painless.
And pay for some.
For some.
You know, what's interesting, Bob Henley, is you don't know this, but my next guest, and I was going to even bring this up, is a professor who's talking about the fact that California just passed a requirement that at California colleges, they must have an ethnic studies courses. They must have at least one course in ethnic studies. And there's been this huge pushback. Obviously, a lot of folks have been begging for this for the longest time, but now that it's mandatory for sure, that means a lot of white people might be going to courses where they're gonna see other people, okay?
Right.
Because they have to learn this together. And as I was thinking about this, I go back to my father. And my father, who grew up in a part of Brooklyn, Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, where there are more Norwegians than in Oslo, Norway, everyone. I mean, this is where I'm. So talk about everyone was last name was Anderson and Hansen and Arneson. And he had never met a person of color. He had never really met a Jew. He had never met an Italian. This is how. And it wasn't until he served in the military.
Right.
That for the first time in his entire life, he saw America.
Such a good point.
And this was Brooklyn, everyone. He didn't have to live in the rural parts of the United States to be isolated. He was isolated in Bay Ridge, all right? And my dad, as much as he was a conservative Yahoo and we would fight all the time, he said that that was a gift. That what was a gift was that the guy on the bunk above him came from someplace in Arkansas he'd never heard of. And the guy that was next to him came from someplace in California he'd always wanted to visit. And I think that the decision by Nixon to start with, to do this voluntary military, that was the beginning of Donald Trump.
Absolutely.
Was the beginning of Donald Trump.
Right. And this idea of the permanent warrior class, and then also their disillusionment, because it was Donald Trump that spoke to them in 2016 in South Carolina. I remember covering this when he actually was the skunk of the garden party that called into question the fact that both Democrats and Republicans kept throwing this voluntary military year after year, deployment after deployment, and he called the question. And people thought, oh, in South Carolina, where there's a high concentration of retired and active duty military, that will be it for Donald Trump. Well, no. And this is something he's done very well. He recognizes you by mentioning you and then betrays you. So that's what he does with working class people. He mentions you, I see your pain. Then of course he passes a tax cut that benefits the people that have been messing with you for your entire life. And the same thing with the military. He recognized their suffering and then undercut them. But that's the importance of, and that's why I was heartened to see Joe Biden recognize African Americans and recognize that his agency was reliant on their investment in him.
And I've been saying over and over again, the most amazing part of the Biden win is in one city. They heard it yesterday. You're going to hear it again today, folks. And that is Philadelphia. Philadelphia, not Pennsylvania. Philadelphia delivered the win for Joe Biden. Philadelphia is the poorest city in America. I want every, not only is it have a significant portion of African Americans, of Blacks in that city, but it is the poorest city. Right. And so think about this. I think about, you know, Bloomberg spending, you know, millions. I'm going to go into Texas. I'm going to go into Florida. Right. Bloomberg spending millions to even, you know, waste some time during this primary. And yet what ends up delivering for the Democratic Party isn't the billionaires. It isn't the people that said, I'll write the checks. It is Philadelphia, the poorest city in America. I mean, make me weep. So before I let you go, I have to ask this question.
Sure.
A significant portion of African Americans and Blacks voted for Barack Obama, but he really didn't do what I think they expected him to do.
Right. And they stayed
But
on.
His vice president, Joe Biden, had the license to say what Barack Obama never said, which was that I see you. Right. And because of you, right, I am here.
Right.
And that also plays to a continuation of our racism. The Black president couldn't say it, but the white president could say it. What does that say about us?
Well, and also we have to be aware, those of us of a certain age, that when we were enthusiastic about Barack Obama, African Americans gained symbolically the White House, and hundreds of thousands of them lost their own home.
Right.
And that's why they stayed home in 2016. So that's why I don't know this ongoing issue is going to be the central one. And since the pandemic, it's only gotten worse, far more worse. Wealth inequality now is of levels we've never seen.
Well, I'm hoping that not only does he use the words, not only does he say, I see you, Joe Biden, but the best gift is if he does see them and he does hear them and he does policies that will help them, we will be so much better off as a nation. We'll be economically better off. We'll be better educated. We'll be safer when it comes to healthcare. And people have to understand, if he really directs his attention on fixing their lives, he fixes our lives. That's the thing, that's the connection I want people to see. Robert Hennelly, I so love hanging out with you. He is at Stuck Nation. He writes for Insider NJ, The Chief Leader, Salon.com. His most recent piece, which will be up on my Facebook page, How Many Will Perish in the Canyon of Our Growing Red-Blue Divide? Thank you so much for being
here. Till next time.
All right, ciao.
Take care, Ken.
Take care. All right, everyone. We'll be right back. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Stick around.
Galileo's head was on the block. The crime was looking up the truth. And as the bombshells of my daily fears explode, I try to trace them to my youth. And then you had to bring up reincarnation over a couple of beers the other night. And now I'm serving time for mistakes made by another in another lifetime. How long till my soul gets it right? Did any human being ever reach that kind of light? I call on the resting soul of Galileo.
Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Our second guest is just absolutely perfect after we hung out with Robert Hennelly. The title of his piece at theconversation.com, and everyone's going, oh, Arnie loves that site because I probably mine it more than any radio talk show host in America, was entitled, Although Now Required by California Law, Ethnic Studies Courses Likely to be Met with Resistance. The author of that piece is Nolan Cabrera. He's an associate professor of education at the University of Arizona. So just before you come on, Nolan, I, of course, Google, what is ethnic studies? And I sort of put it into my box, and there's like an all section, and then there's a news section. So I thought, before I go to all, I'm gonna hit news to see if anybody else other than Nolan is writing about it. Of course, what's happening in California. And guess what comes up? An article from the Harvard Crimson. And I know that Ken went to Harvard, and I was a fellow at the Institute of Politics at Harvard. So Harvard Crimson, I have to check this out. And it turned out that the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, Dean Gay, hopes to identify ethnic studies faculty by the end of the academic year. And this is today's story from the Harvard Crimson. But the part that I wanted to read to you and will not surprise you, Nolan, is the following paragraph. It begins this way. Harvard affiliates have pushed for a comprehensive ethnic studies program for nearly 5 decades. Let me repeat that, everyone, 5 decades. They're about to hire a cluster, not one, but a cluster of faculty in ethnic studies. But here's the sidebar. But Gay has said it is merely the first step towards a formal program. So we're still inching our way up. But as you come on the air, Harvard is talking about hiring a cluster, I'll do that with air quotes, of ethnic studies professors. So let me welcome you to the program, Nolan. And tell me a little bit about exactly what do we mean by ethnic studies? So I know what some people are pissed off about or what some people wanted. I think I need to know the language and the terms. And why, whether people are offended or embracing it, you think it's incredibly valuable.
Absolutely. So thanks for having me. And just the terminology and definition of it is fraught with tension and disagreement. And for me, I take a lot of solace going back to the original components of ethnic studies. And that is that it came out of the social movements of the 1960s. It was community-based student and faculty-led demands to both expand the knowledge base within institutions of higher education, expand the representation of people of color and marginalized folk, generally speaking, within institutions of higher education, but also seeing those communities as contributors of knowledge, as folks who are actually making meaningful contributions to our knowledge base. And then also trying to break down that wall between the ivory tower and the grassroots communities and say, no, we should be working with and at the service of these grassroots communities. And with a lot of really race-forward, race-centered, and now as it's developed, more intersectional analyses. And by intersectionality, I mean very intentional understanding that, for example, racism in its way we understand it doesn't exist if we don't also have patriarchy and heterosexism, and that there's multiple mutually constructive forces that create the way that we understand and also misunderstand what racism is in contemporary society. And so a lot of that is, I think for me, that's really at the core of it. It's that it's necessarily disruptive, and that makes a lot of people feel really uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But in many respects, that's what we need. We don't, continuing to go in the way that we have been going for so long, it's not working. When we made progress is when we've had agitation. And I think a key issue of that reclamation project is remembering that, like Dr. King was an agitator. He had, when he was assassinated, he had a negative, not just a negative view, or people had a generally negative view of him within the white community. They also had a generally negative view of him within the Black community. They saw him as pushing too hard. Right. And, and so a lot of that's what ethnic studies is it's a very intentional scholarly agitation to bring in more folk of color into higher education, and then try to make higher education actually meaningful for the communities themselves. That's a higher ed specific. Ethnic studies as a whole has that general frame, just not having to say higher education.
So I as I'm listening to you and I'm thinking about the fact that it's kind of the idea that we need to see the country we live in. We need to see the communities that make up the country. We need to see the value of all these people. We need to understand that they've made contributions. It isn't just the contribution of the scientist. It isn't just the contribution of the lawyer. It's the idea of who built the White House, you know? Who saved Joe Biden? I mentioned before, the poorest city in America saved Joe Biden. You know, an ethnically diverse but predominantly Black, you know, Philadelphia saved Joe Biden. Let's know this. But as I'm listening to you, I write down an interesting word. I write down the word that we have always been, for whatever reason, so xenophobic, that we don't even want to see the world, let alone see people within our country. The idea that somehow it challenges our sense of self. And I'm thinking, how can you see it that way as opposed to enriching our sense of self? You know, that somehow this is about competition or the idea that you have to hold someone down in order to lift yourself up. And in the end, if you're holding someone down, you can't get very far up, you know, yes. that whole concept. Yes. So I understand the idea. I applaud the idea of ethnic studies. It must have been a struggle. And the fact that it's California is not a surprise to me, but that it wasn't quickly embraced, that there is still a lot of animosity because it is a requirement. It is not just, oh, it's going to be made available on every campus. It is now a requirement for graduation. So let's talk about that idea of requirement. Is it better to voluntarily participate, or is it better to require everyone to participate?
The short answer of it for me is that it's better to make everybody participate. Because to the extent that that systemic racism is a collective issue, it can't just be on the shoulders of racial activists, which largely means the labor is on communities of color and largely on women of color to make this a racism-free society. And that's just, A, it's unreasonable as a labor demand, and B, it absolves a lot of people in their individual responsibilities in how it is that we're dealing with racism right now. And the interesting, yeah, so I definitely think that it needs to be a requirement, because again, otherwise folks are not going to just take them out of interest as a cute little sidebar. And at the same time, it also becomes a really important signaling, like when institutions of higher education are saying, you know, we're going to invest in fill in the blank. It's a statement of institutional values. They're saying this is something at the core of our institution of what we do. A lot of times that basically means STEM fields. You know, we're going to try to make the next group of folks that are make the next, you know, cute little widget, like, you know, earbuds and iPhones. And this is a potential to harness that and put it to something really productive, because we talk about democratic education. I don't mean like as in the Democratic Party, I mean as in democracy. And ultimately, it's not to be too simplistic, but democracy derives from the roots of demos, meaning people, and crassi, meaning rule, and simply not possible to have a rule by the people if there's systemic inequities, if some people are made more equal than others.
Well, you know, we had on about 2 years ago on the 4th of July, we had on one of the, I guess, fifth great, 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 great grandchild of Thomas Jefferson. And he's the one that forced the concept of Sally Hemings and the idea that she was there too. And that where she lived, you know, Monticello was, yeah. You know, this is an amazing story. Sally Hemings' quarters had been turned into a public bathroom at Monticello. All right? This is who she was. All right, not surprised. And yeah. She's the mother of Thomas Jefferson's children. She went with him. I mean, it's when you begin to, that she is one of the founding mothers of America, everyone. But there was no knowledge of her, no recognition of her, and her living space had been turned into a public restroom. Well, that's completely changed now. The family was not happy, a lot of the Thomas Jefferson family, but the one that I got to meet who really sort of forced the issue said, she is us. She is us. So in an interesting way, ethnic studies isn't about the other, it is us. Mm-hmm. It is us. So as you look at the courses that are being required at California, How do you break down ethnic studies? So for example, they're talking about bringing in a cluster of faculty at Harvard, but it's not a program yet, not a formal program. But what does a formal program look like? What are the different sort of themes within ethnic studies that people study, bring to the table, so that we learn so much more about who we are and really the baggage that we carry as citizens that we need to at least acknowledge and maybe rehabilitate?
So traditionally, and going back to the 1960s, each identity group was really strongly advocating for their own area. So you had Chicano and Mexican American studies, especially very prevalent in the Southwest and Southern California, Black studies, African American studies, Africana studies, and then under that, you know, and then also Asian American studies, Native American studies, et cetera. And so it is kind of difficult to talk about ethnic studies as kind of a collective whole because you have so many diverse areas, but there are a lot of common themes across in terms of systemic racism, endemic colonialism. And then, like I said earlier, that a lot of the modern day incarnations, which have been incredibly important, are things like Chicana feminism or Black feminist thought that have really started to look at all of that. And you know, Harvard is, let's be honest, Harvard is creating this cluster hire because they were thoroughly embarrassed by their one of their bright shining stars in their ethnic studies program was denied. She was denied tenure. And it was one of these things that they said, well, you know, her citation index and all this stuff. Yeah, the citation index is a measure of academic popularity. How many folks in academia say, as I'm writing my paper, I cite your work? And yeah, that's one measure of your impact. But you talk to her students, you see the community work that she did, and she still put out a lot of scholarly work. It's incredible. And but they're so, you know, we are Harvard, and so they have egg on their face, and they have what, a $30 billion endowment. This is not you know,
but you know what it is? It's a race-based standard at Harvard.
Yes.
So she didn't fit into their standard, just the way kids who take the SATs don't know how to answer those questions because it isn't their life experience. I don't know their life. And if I was given an SAT based on their life, I would get like 200, you know? And so in an interesting way, what Harvard could not come to grips with is that the standard they set is a standard that probably applied to a lot of white men for the most part. Ask Larry Summers about this. But no, Ken, you want to weigh in? I don't want to ignore it.
Yeah, sure. As Arnie mentioned, I was an undergraduate at Harvard 50 years ago when the fight was on to start a Black Studies program at Harvard. And Harvard then also was remarkably short-sighted, would be way too generous. They were just, same thing about denying tenure because you weren't cited enough. They said there weren't enough African-American scholars who were rigorous enough in their scholarship to be good enough to merit a chair at Harvard. And maybe they could come as visitors, but can't have actually tenured. You know, we can't have an actual department. It was the exact same BS, and they were slinging it 50 years ago, and they're still slinging it. It's amazing. But I got to say one other thing that was going on at the time, which I wonder whether you can say it's going on now, either at Harvard or the other schools or in California. The Black Power movement was active in the country, and there was a Black Students Union at Harvard, which was pretty strong in its demands. And the ilk of SDS, not quite as left in terms of the economy and being viewed as communists or anything, but they were strong in their demands about African Americans, people of color being admitted. And Harvard was, I think that one of the reasons they went along and adopted the Black Studies program was in order to short circuit the actual radical Black politics and make it, okay, we're going to come in and have professors talk about academic theories about African-American history, but we're not going to actually, what you were saying about bringing in people who are more tied to the community and the roots and activism and increasing Black participation in the economy and politics and everything. And they sure as heck were not going to get people like the folks that were in the Black Studies program who were rabble-rousing. They were going to hire real academic theoreticians.
So, Go on, Nolan, please weigh in.
And I was just going to say, and the way that framing right there, real academics, real education.
Absolutely.
And separating those two out as if they're antithetical ideas is core to that. And the thing is, I was deeply involved. It's extraordinarily elitist. And the thing is that I was also deeply involved in the controversy around the state of Arizona banning Mexican American studies in Tucson, Arizona. Right. And in that case as well, you had leaders, and this wasn't just like rabid Republicans. This was like, you know, center left white liberals in Tucson who were saying, no, can't we as Tucson Unified just get back to real education again, as if that's
real education. Oh my God.
Exactly. When in fact the students in Tucson Unified were graduating at some of the highest rates of any group in the entire district from taking this Mexican American studies classes.
Well, you know, it's so shocking to me, but what I guess I want to ask a question. So you go into an ethnic studies class, and let's say, so do we look at it as a story about Asian Americans? Do we break it up that way? And if we break it up that way, so we're sort of compartmentalizing our ethnic studies, what do you learn in ethnic studies about that group? Do you learn about that group? Do you learn about that group in interaction with America? I'm just trying to figure out what are the components of this, because that's one of the reasons why I want to take courses in it, because I want to know and see and hear differently, but I don't know what the inputs are. And so I'm kind of curious, what are the inputs?
So there's a lot of different components to it, but to break it down, distill it to two sort of very foundational components.
Right.
One is to really examine and put as a centerpiece of the educational experience, the cultural intellectual contributions of those who the United States has largely written off.
Right.
That's one core component, because again, you can only say this is real education if you're completely dismissing all of that, you know, and then it also has ridiculous damaging psychological effects on the students of color. Like Ronald Takaki, the brilliant ethnic studies educator, made a profound statement in the beginning of his book, A Different Mirror, where he said, what happens when someone with the power of a teacher tells the story of your country and you're not in it? It can create a moment of psychic disequilibrium as if you looked into a mirror and saw nothing.
Right.
And so then he's holding up these different mirrors. They provide affirmation for marginalized students, but also a different mirror for people of the dominant group. At the same time, though, we have to be truth tellers about the ugly realities that the United States has engaged in. You know, the judge in the Mexican American Studies case, Judge Tashima, was interned in Poston. This is not ancient history. This is a gentleman who's like right here, right now. You know, and so it's too easy for us. I know this is a complete simplistic cliche, but the whole, you know, those who don't learn from the past are doomed to recreate it. That's exactly what's going on now. You know, that if we had really learned something from internment, kids in cages wouldn't be an issue now.
Right.
And that's,
it had been part of what we studied. Yeah, who really studied this? You might have gotten one sentence. That was
exactly
it. One sentence. Yes. You didn't understand what the consequences for lives, what was taken from them. It's so interesting that we're talking, everyone, we're Zooming on Monday afternoon. And I just want everyone to know on Monday afternoon what happened. But Katherine Johnson, the brilliant Apollo mathematician, the African-American mathematician, died at 101. Yes. No one knew her until they made a movie about her. They had to make a movie about her. And because of the movie, she got an award. And because of the movie, she got a following. And because of them, but that was long after she had made her contribution. she was in her freaking 90s before anyone even knew she existed. And yet she was known as the human computer. The astronauts trusted her over the equipment. That was how important she was. But why was she so unknown? If anybody wants to understand why you need ethnic studies, Katherine Johnson is one of the reasons why you need ethnic studies, because a celebration of a life shouldn't happen when you're in your 90s and your contribution occurred like 40 or 50 years before. And that's That's where I wish people weren't afraid. I wish they were curious. Mm-hmm. I want them to be curious and not afraid.
Absolutely. And a lot of that comes down to it, that in many respects, the difficulty that people have with ethnic studies is it disrupts what James Baldwin referred to as the big lie. And that is that essentially that America has been this benevolent country. And it was sort of like, oops, we made a mistake here. Oops, we made a mistake there. And it actually exposes that and says, no, this is really woven into the fabric of our society. This isn't even like people use kind of the terminology of a cancer. And that's something that, you know, you can kind of, I have a tumor, I can remove it. I can go to radiation. This is really, systemic. Really intricate. It's systemic in our areas. And it comes down deeply into that.
Yeah, Ken?
Yeah, I was going to add to that. You know, it's not only woven into our society, but it is really, racism is the fundamental reason why a lot of the things that are wrong with our society are built into our Constitution. You know, the Electoral College, every state, including big ones and small ones, getting the same two senators, where they have, you know, 50 million people or 1 million people. All of those things came about in the Constitution because of compromise with slavery, so that the Southern states could continue to own slaves and would still buy into a united country. And we're still tethered
back to that.
Matter. I mean, it was part of who we, not just interwoven, it's why we did the things we did.
But let me make a positive statement at the end of this conversation, and Nolan, you will love it. So I am this, you know, liberal, progressive, feminist, whatever, you know, and my second husband was a libertarian, Republican atheist. Okay. He had never voted for me. I think he was a little homophobic when he met me. His family, although he didn't realize were racist, he began to realize were. And the beauty is I fell in love with him, all right? But because of his exposure to me and my exposure to him, we both grew. We weren't afraid of what we thought. We challenged each other about what we thought. We opened our eyes because of what he thought and what I thought. And instead of it creating a schism between us, it both brought us closer and it brought us stronger and it made us more aware of everything in our world. And I want people to understand, because someone is a racist, they're not a bad person. It's that they haven't been exposed or they've chosen to go like this and close their eyes and their ears. And part of the beauty of this requirement of ethnic studies is that you're going to bring a lot of people who don't want to admit they're a racist, don't want to deal with it, just the way you don't want to deal with your drug addiction when you're an addict, you know? And yet, in the end, if you deal with your drug addiction, if you deal with your racism, you're so much better off because you did. And that's, I think, the value of these studies, is that, you know, we're seeing the level of segregation increasing in America. And that's a horrible thing, because as the planet is getting smaller and as social media is bringing us together and as climate change is forcing us all to live with the complications and the pandemic will potentially kill a lot of us, the idea of not seeing us or recognizing us is not useful, especially at this time.
And I think that's one of the big things about it is that you're 100% right that, you know, I don't like really thinking about people as a racist or not a racist. Mm-hmm. If it's a systemic reality, the bigger issue is more at one point, what, like, did my actions in this situation support systemic racism or challenge systemic racism? And it means it really complicates the situation, because in many respects, racism and anti-racism can and do exist within the same body. And if we're sitting there looking to demonize and say, you're a racist, the conversation never goes anywhere. But in many respects, it goes back. And I hope you don't mind if I quote James Baldwin really quickly.
No, please do.
But he had this beautiful, beautiful quote. I put it in the chat so that I would remember it, because you never stop during a hoedown and you never misquote James Baldwin. Those are two truths that I know from Oregon. So he said, yet it is only when a man is able without bitterness or self-pity to surrender a dream he long cherished or privilege he has long possessed that he's set free, and he has set himself free for higher dreams and for greater privileges. And for me, that's the essence of what we're talking about here, that you're setting yourself free from the big lie. You're setting yourself free from this, you know, the arc that America is so perfect and great, and grappling with truth and the difficulties and having the strength to look within and see how I am a flawed person, and also having avenues to improve on it, and letting go of the false promise of white privilege in the sense that our collective humanity is a higher dream and a greater privilege as we reaffirm the humanity of each other as a whole.
And how important and how much better will it be for all of us to walk into a room and have a sense of trust first, as opposed to a sense of fear? You know, I will end. We went to Jamaica when I lost my race for governor. Someone actually gave us a gift. And my two little blonde children were in the bank in Jamaica. And all of a sudden, Melissa grabs my leg. And I said, "What's wrong?" She said, "Nobody looks like me." I said, "I know." I said, "Welcome to the world. Yeah. Nobody looks like you." So it's an interesting time. And when does awareness begin? And thank you so much.
Can I just add that's what I used to do, school desegregation cases in South and in the North. And that's why I thought school desegregation was so important, because when little kids grow up together, you're not the other, you're not the black kid, and you're not the white kid, you're not the
just the kid. You're just
my friend who plays soccer with me, you know, or exactly. Who does crafts with me.
Exactly. Title of the article: at theconversation.com. Although now required by California law, ethnic studies courses likely to be met with resistance. Not after they hear this conversation, Nolan. I'm telling you right now, they have to all want to make sure they take it. Thank you so much. Nolan Cabrera teaches at the University of Arizona. He's an associate professor of education. And thank you for teaching us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. You have a beautiful day.
All right, you too. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao. Change.